by neuroscientists to improve memory and attention. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
It is Saturday, November 16th, 2013. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, hosting today, and with me in the studio is Lyle Troxell, your usual host, who's also a programmer, photographer, and father. And
howdy.
Ben Jaffe. Hey, Lyle, how's it going? Ben, you're a technology teacher, musician, web developer, and organic farmer enthusiast.
I am. Maybe we should put musician
instead of
farmer.
The geeks and the farmers can be friends.
You could change that. You could change that right now.
Oh, yeah, I guess I just changed it on the
You have the technology.
You know, it's actually kind of interesting. We do run the show via an online document that we edit all at the same time, mm-hmm. which is kind of a fun way to do it.
Yeah.
And we've got copies and copies and copies of this document cluttering up my inboxes. But in any case,
I have to say, I actually miss when we had Etherpad. Do you remember Etherpad?
Yes.
It was a wonderful collaborative online tool.
Do you know Etherpad?
Lightweight.
The people that made Etherpad were bought up by Google.
Mm-hmm.
Yum, 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 yum.
your yum, yum, yum was better sound than mine. Mine sounded kind of like a dog sniffing
your ear.
They
were good in combination.
Yeah,
that's
okay, good.
That's how I feel about that.
So, and we had a call a while ago about, what was that thing you used? So I looked it up, and we used Etherpad a lot, and it's a totally open source project now.
Source.
You can run it on your own server, and lots of companies are actually
sharing. Why aren't we
sharing
using it anymore?
Well, we switched over to this, and that's why. I mean, it's
because you're a
reason.
Google head. That's why.
No. We didn't even say I said an online document. I didn't say what type.
It's Google Docs, ladies and gentlemen. I'm telling on Lyle.
Bonnie's a Google head.
Mm-hmm.
I like Google head. That's
Google
good.
Head. It's better than
I'm not wearing glass today. I don't know if you noticed.
I see that. Yes. No. It's just, so that's what you look
like. I
have like
the shakes.
The DTs.
Yeah.
All right, gang. Let's talk about some geek news, because there's been plenty of it.
Yeah.
What's this about a Cyanogen mod Windows installer, young Ben?
Yeah, young Ben. Cyanogen mod. So Cyanogen is a noxious gas, but we're not going to talk about that. Cyanogen mod is...
it's a way of using it for good?
Well, it has nothing to do with Cyanogen. I think it's just a cool name, right?
Yeah.
But basically, Android, the Android project that Google's been working on for ages and that a lot of us have in our pockets, is actually open source, or rather, it is released through the Android open source project.
Uh-huh.
And so what that means is you can download that code, you can tweak it however you want and re-release it.
You can customize your phone that way and make it possible for other people to.
Yeah, it's kind of like Linux.
Learned.
You know, you can change whatever you want in the Linux kernel and then run that on your device.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some awesome guy decided, you know what, I'm going to do Android, everything that Android is doing, except I'm going to make it better. I'm going to add all these features that I want and that other people want. And that was what Cyanogen mod was.
And is it for Android phones?
It's for Android phones. So you can decide to, instead of running your normal Android operating system that comes with the phone, or maybe the Samsung or HTC or whoever branded operating system, you can install instead Cyanogen mod. And the great thing about that is if you root your phone and you do that and everything, it's generally a lot more customizable. I'm a settings head. I like settings. I really like tweaking settings. So Cyanogen mod gives me a lot of settings. The Cyanogen mod Windows installer just simply makes it way easier to install Cyanogen mod.
Okay.
If you wanted to do it before...
If your primary operating system is a Windows operating system and you want to put it on an Android device...
That's true.
That installer makes it easier.
Well, it's funny, actually. So, I'll tell you my little story with this in just a second. But what you had to do before, I installed it on my Nexus One. Remember that phone? The
yes.
first Google phone? So, I got a Nexus One way back when, and then I installed Cyanogen mod on it. But the way I had to do that is I had to unlock the bootloader and root the phone and load the custom ROM onto the thing
there
via
were steps
SD card and da-da-da-da-da,
yeah.
and then run it and install it, and then I had Cyanogen mod. So super easy peasy, any Joe Schmo could do it, right? No, not really. It was a little bit complicated, right? I kind of had to... And the other thing is, I never really felt like I quite knew what I was doing,
uh-huh.
which is... I mean, it's familiar territory for me and for a lot of geeks, but it's not so much a good sign if someone's trying to do something and they have no idea what they're doing, but they somehow get to the right solution or wrong solution. So anyway, CyanogenMod Windows Installer makes it super easy. You just plug in your phone and theoretically everything goes off without a hitch. I almost...
That's always the theoretical goal.
This morning... This morning, I'm just sitting in the other room over there looking up news stories, and I've been thinking about this news story for a couple days, and so I decided, you know what, I really want to do this now, because how cool would that be to go on the air and be like, I just did this with my, in fact, it's just finishing up right now. So,
happened?
Well...
I don't see a phone next to you, Ben. Yeah.
The reason I decided, I was literally about to click go.
Yeah.
And then I thought, this is a stupid idea, because... Yes. I need my phone for navigation to a place I've never been in San Francisco before.
Oh, that's
later today. And, you know, just things like that. I mean,
this gets to what you were talking about last week, Lyle, where when doing an update or any kind of major anything, don't do it right before something important where
yes,
you need that device.
It's very crucial. Yeah. Exactly.
So good.
And this happens to me commonly, Ben, as well, is that
you get an idea.
I'm researching Geek News the day before Geek Speak, and I go, ooh, it's time to do this. But the truth is, lately I've been finding that I don't run into a lot of problems. I don't know why. By the way, I was running CyanogenMod. I had a phone that was loaned to me for a while when I switched away from iOS. For the last probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, I've been running CyanogenMod on an old Nexus or some old phone.
Really? Have you been using the phone, though?
I was using the phone as my primary phone. Sure,
oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
How'd you like it?
It rebooted a lot. So I saw that logo, that CyanogenMod logo happened a lot. So I don't know.
It's branding.
It was not very stable is what my experience was. Yeah. But yes, it's very customizable. And since, you know, for now, about a week and a half, I've been running on Android 4.4 out of the box. Like that's Google's release of the operating system without any modifications except for what Google offers it. I haven't had it crash at all yet, but it's a brand new phone. So who knows?
My phone has started crashing.
And I haven't really missed. There's a few things in CyanogenMod that was kind of cool, but I haven't mixed it much. Android, but in general, is more customizable than iOS. So
it's already sort of customized friendly.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
The reason I'm starting to think about this is because my phone, which is not running CyanogenMod, I'm running stock what comes with my phone. It's a S3. And it started inexplicably crashing recently.
Okay. Well, now, CyanogenMod Group, that group is actually forming a company and are going to be releasing that as a real OS. So, I mean, in the sense that it won't be a hackable thing. It'll be something that's actually structured. So it's kind of interesting to see
operating system. Folks.
Yeah, exactly.
You've been tinkering with other aspects of cell phones lately.
That's right.
You want to get a different carrier.
Yeah, I hate carriers.
it's just
problem.
In general.
So I had, you know, a couple weeks ago, I had this, the day before GeekSpeak last week, I had this conversation with AT&T saying, why are you charging me all this? And the website, I couldn't get something to change. Yeah. Basically, I had an old package and I couldn't move it. And I was kind of frustrated. And I said, talk to me. You know, I'd love to talk to you. They didn't want to talk to me. So I looked at some of these other carriers, and there's basically these subcarrier companies that actually provide you service on the primary carriers.
Right.
AT&T and Singular, and there's one other, Sprint,
Singular. Sprint?
Sprint? I don't know.
Verizon. And AT&T are the big ones.
Those are the actual
networks.
They
own the actual towers, right?
Right. Yeah. They own the infrastructure. So when you get a phone, the type of antenna kind of determines where you're going to be. The new phones seem to have all antennas, so that's less of an issue.
And last week we were talking about how there's some of these carriers manage somehow to provide cheaper services, even though they're using AT&T or Sprint.
When
or
I was on the phone with AT&T, you know, tech support, I said, or chatting with them, I said, you know, why would I pay for your service when it's double the price I can get on the same, it's still your network, I don't understand.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, the service won't be as good. And I'm thinking as a technologist, like, well, how? Because they're still the same, and it's still the same network. Why would it be unstable? So I switched to Net 10. It was really a pain to do. When I was going through their website and stuff, they just have some silly rules. Like, you have to go buy one of those cards at a store. But they're at, like, every store.
Right.
And this is what I went to.
Was it like a phone card?
Yeah.
Kind of a thing?
It's a phone card, prepaid phone card. But then it's a regular updating prepaid. So I don't know.
Oh, so once you've got the card, you can remotely update it.
And I think it's because the activity, they don't want to deal with your credit card exactly. And you buy this card and you're kind of, it's like a pseudo credit card kind of thing.
Uh-huh. It's like a PayPal thing.
Yeah. I haven't gone through another cycle yet. And I will. But the thing is that the price of the Net 10, which runs on AT&T, is half the price of what I could do through AT&T.
Okay.
It's more than half the price. Less than half the price. And theoretically, it's more coverage because at AT&T, I was limited to a certain amount and then I only had a 5 gig, whatever, and they start charging me.
Yeah.
This other company, I think it's 2.5 gigabytes of transfer, but they never start charging you. They just slow the network down. You don't get on the high network. You get on the lower speed network later.
Is that what you want, though, to be sort of slowed down?
Well, I'd like a consistent bill that's less.
Consistent. So what's more important to you is a bill that's consistently manageable.
Yeah. Because the truth is, when I want to make a long, like I can't make long distance calls, or I can't make out of the country calls with this network, I don't think.
Yeah.
But I can use Skype whenever I want.
Right.
So it's really more about, I'm not going to get surprised by $40 of extra charges because of text or something.
Okay, that's, you know, what you
unlimited texting, things like that. Yeah.
It's interesting to note also, when you talk about cell phone speed, it's not really what we usually think about. If you're using Skype, for example, you're going to hear maybe a really nice, crisp, clear voice. But then if you're on a really bad network, you're just going to hear a little bit fuzzier of a voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to really experience a huge difference. When we're talking about my cell phone is really slow, it accesses the internet really slow, we're talking about latency.
Right.
So you hit a web page and it takes like 10 seconds to get back to you.
Right.
That's not what they do probably. They just slow down your download speed so that way things like Skype are going to bring themselves to a lower quality level and things like that.
What I was noticing about doing this Net10 thing, I got excited about these sub-carrier possibilities through this company called Ting, which does the Sprint or Verizon. I don't know. One of the other networks.
Another network.
Right.
Yeah,
and I had to transfer my phone number to another company, which is a little scary. The process of doing it is actually kind of technical. But Net10 does not help you with that at all. It's like really hard to do in the sense that you've got to change
guided.
These settings. No.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, updating your email client when your SMTP settings change. Like, I'm so aware of that space. The phone's like that. And
it sounds like a service for the geeky and the hack-friendly.
Yeah. If you're a geeky, hack-friendly kind of person, then half your phone bill, no problem.
Yeah.
But if you're not, I don't know. Because I can't go to a store and have them help me, right?
Yeah.
Like with the carriers, you can go to a store and have them set up the phone.
Okay.
But it is interesting to see that all the settings inside a phone are very much like web settings.
You're not paying for tech support with Net10.
No,
apparently.
No, I guess not. Yeah, to customer service. And I'm just surprised how my take home from interacting with them was, wow, it must be really easy to have a successful business. I wish I was a little bit more business inclined because I could do this so much better than them. What are they doing?
Yeah.
Like their documentation's bad. It's the
Well, that's interesting, Lyle, because if part of your move to want to get away from AT&T is just the difficulty of talking to someone, here you are at Net10, which is even trickier to
get. It's not the difficulty. I mean, I really just wanted to lessen my bill. You know, if I look at my bill and my family bill, it is a lot of money per month. I was spending at AT&T probably over $200 a month on cell phone uses. This new place, I'll be spending something like half that, a little bit less than half of that.
That's so
and
much
that adds
money.
Up. Yeah, exactly. That's it's crazy. All right.
Well, we're going to talk about phones a bit more after the break. You can use yours, too. We're taking calls today. Rick is here to take your call. So if you've got any questions for the geeks, Lyle and Ben, I could pretend to answer something also, then do give us a call. The number is 800-655-5877. This is Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the air room is Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. Listen, another great show on KUSP's The 7th Avenue Project. And next time, they pose this question. What do you buy the children of the terrorist who tried to kill your wife? That's a convoluted question. After a bombing in Jerusalem left 9 dead and his wife badly injured, David Harris Gershon came down with a nasty case of PTSD, and conventional therapy didn't work. So Harris Gershon tried a radical solution to reach out to the family of the bomber in a spirit of reconciliation. He tells KUSP's Robert Pauly what happened on the next 7th Avenue Project. That's tomorrow at noon on 88.9 KUSP or KUSP.org. Well, Lyle, Ben, before the break, we were talking a bit about phones, and there's more there to be said.
Yeah, I wanted to make just a basic thing. I realized that, and listen to Geek Speak, which I do pretty regularly, I realized that we don't cover some of this stuff at a base level sometimes because there's so much knowledge we already all share.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to say, first off, that the operating systems for your phones are Windows phones,
mm-hmm.
BlackBerry, but kind of disappearing, Android, which Cyanogen Meadow is a version of Android.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Google open source project, and you can fork it, and lots of companies release it. And when they do release a phone with Android on it, sometimes there's other stuff on top of it. We won't get into that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is iOS.
Right.
That's
iPhones. Apple's
iPhones,
basically.
Apples. Okay.
And the only way to get iOS on your phone is to buy a device from Apple.
Uh-huh.
So those are the four: BlackBerry, iOS, Android, and
Windows Phone.
And so those are the operating systems that you use to interact with your phone.
That's right.
And I'm just hearing from Ben that there's a whole other operating system mobile devices use to communicate with cell phone towers.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Okay. So the operating systems that we deal with.
The ones I just listed.
The ones you just listed, those four, those are not what I'm talking about right now.
Right.
I'm talking about the thing that actually connects your phone to the radio tower. It turns out connecting a device to a 3G or cell of any sort, radio tower, is actually really, really difficult. The managing the radio, the timing, getting everything exactly right to make it work is very, very difficult. So we have this special operating system that we never really interact with in any way. We only see the results, which is that our phone works, right? And this operating system is stored in firmware, and it runs on the baseband processor. There's actually two processors in your phone that we're talking about now.
Okay.
The main processor, right? I'll put main in air quotes here, okay?
Yeah,
the main
that's
processor.
That's the one that you're mostly interacting with.
That's the one that iOS or Android or Windows Phone or BlackBerry, that's the one that they run on.
Yeah.
The baseband processor is the one that this firmware operating system runs on. And it's called baseband software. And we don't talk about it very much. We talk about security vulnerabilities with our iOS devices or Android devices or anything like that. We never talk about it.
What about this baseband thing?
So,
what's the security issues there?
Here's the deal. This baseband software and the processors and radios and all that stuff was designed in the 80s and the 90s. Mm-hmm. And the 90s attitude towards security, as it puts it in the article, was that we didn't really think about it very much, right? And so we're not thinking when we're designing this baseband software in the 80s and 90s, what if someone tries to compromise the device this way or something that, right?
Since then, people have thought about that.
Yeah, and so the problem with this software, which is running on every single one of our phones, is that nothing is checked. Everything is trusted completely automatically. And in addition, the baseband processor in mobile devices is usually technically the master processor. The application processor, the thing that runs Android and iOS, that's actually the slave processor. Mm-hmm. So summarizing all of this, we have a complete operating system. This is from the article. It says, so we have a complete operating system running on an ARM processor, an ARM processor, without any exploit mitigation, meaning anything that is an exploit can just run free, run rampant, which automatically trusts every instruction, piece of code, or data it receives from the base station, that's the cell tower, that you're connected to.
That sounds dangerous.
What could possibly go wrong? Says
just
the article.
Blind trust, yeah.
Yeah, so this article is talking... Yo, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the base station, of course, what it is an antenna connected to a computer with network behind it.
Yeah, right?
That's the
thing.
So therefore, if that station has absolute control, command control over all the phones attached to it, this is actually how you get those notification systems.
That might
systems.
Be a way to kind of muck up a bunch of devices at
once. Yeah, you could hack one of those stations and then take care of everybody's phone in that area.
So hackers, take note.
Wait, so you... So you just said...
What are we doing?
You just said you could hack one of those stations and take over a bunch of phones. So what would that entail? That would entail scaling some fence, breaking into something, figuring out everything. No, you're probably...
There must be some remote way to do it, though.
Maybe you might be able to do it remotely. But what about this? What about if you build your own base station
and then
go to a crowded train station and just set up this small powered base station in some corner somewhere? Well, everyone... So
why are we giving people ideas?
Well, we've
Geeks already have these ideas. Yeah, this is how we think.
The people who are going to exploit this already know about this.
The people who don't know
about this are not the people who are going to exploit this. They're not in this space.
Oh, dear, dear.
So we've talked about these security issues that, like, phones are just going to connect to a base station that they see, the strongest base station. They'll just kind of blindly trust it. I mean, there may be a little bit of security, but not very much.
No, you know, one of the things I noticed when I was setting up my phone with this new carrier is that I had to put in proxy settings for some of the search features. For the SMS messaging, I was setting proxies, and it was HTTP proxies. I'm like, what?
Well,
it's not even HTTPS?
HTTP is insecure. HTTPS yeah. is
Which basically
secure.
All S my text secure. Messages, all my SMS messages that go out of my phone and into my phone are completely readable by anybody on the same network as me.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of people.
Which is really bad if you're
it's
in an airport or something.
Yeah. Is that true for all phones or is that just a function
Well, that's
of
the thing is,
10?
I only knew that because I typed it in myself. Yeah. But with these other phones, automatically, that station that Ben was talking about sets that for you.
HTTP.
Yeah. So I don't know which way it is or not. I don't know. But clearly the security vulnerabilities.
Why is every time I leave the show, I get scared to do anything?
You know what? As long as you don't care if people look at you and steal your money, you're fine. Don't be scared.
Okay, all right.
You'll be fine, Bonnie.
I guess there's no problem.
So this story is security researcher Ralph Philip Weinman of the University of Luxembourg. Basically, he went out and he tried to reverse engineer the baseband processor of Qualcomm and Infineon.
And how'd he do?
He found a lot of bugs all over the place. And every one of the bugs that he found or that he talked about could lead to exploits. Now, what do I mean by exploits? I'm talking about things like crashing the device. Okay, so that's okay.
One
Your device crashes.
Yeah.
Allowing the attacker to remotely execute code. Now, that's a huge one.
Yeah.
If an attacker can remotely execute code, this is remotely. They don't have to touch your device. They don't even have to know where your device is. Mm-hmm. But if they can remotely execute code, they can get to pretty much anything on your phone. And then you can turn on auto answer, right? Silently. Mm-hmm. So you can make the phone automatically answer phone calls without making any sounds, and then you can call the phones and get audio feeds. So if you do that in an airport or something like that, you get all this audio data. So these are all terrifying
it's
ideas.
It's so funny, but when you hear that, when you describe that terrifying idea, I go, that's a cool art project. That's what working in art felt for 10 years does to me. I'm like, oh, you could record all those sounds and then play them back.
And just
weird feedback.
Oh, no. Well, so now, because this is being talked about, that means Hackers for Good are starting on the project of guarding against these things?
Maybe. Well, I mean, the problem is, how is a Hacker for Good going to fix your phone? I mean,
more than that, like how the infrastructure is so massive, and it's the cell phone carriers are the ones in control of those computers, and they don't share that information. It's completely private.
Yeah.
So the only reason this guy is able to figure it out is because they backward engineered it.
Yeah. So it's not so much a problem with your phone. Or a problem with
the entire design
the carrier.
Of the system.
It's like everything, right?
Oh, God.
That's pretty bad.
God, we're saps. We're just such trusting saps out there.
Why is it this way? So I was talking about earlier, we've got the software from the 80s and 90s, and it has a 90s security viewpoint in mind, and that's why it's so horrible. Why are carriers still using this software? Why don't they build something that is good for the 20th century? I mean,
because they don't need to still sell a service.
Well, partially because they don't need to, and partially because it's ridiculously hard and ridiculously expensive because it's hard. Because what you have to do is you have to implement the GSM standard, for example, is ridiculously long, ridiculously convoluted and complicated. Because it has this huge history. If you're going to implement baseband software, you need to implement the GSM standard as well as some other standards.
Right, and
as
you
well.
Have to be backwards compatible. You're going to break
UMTS
phones.
UMTS and HSDPA, all these standards that make this communication with the servers and the towers and everything possible.
Let me just argue, though, that they're making a lot of money already. So why don't they fix this problem? They should invest in their technology.
They're not going to until they have to pay for fixing a bunch of phones getting hacked.
Right.
I don't want to defend them, but there's one other reason. And that's because if you want to make baseband software, it has to be certified by communications authorities, which is a bunch of red tape. And,
well, let me ask you, these newer technologies, these 4G technologies, LTE, other stuff of that nature, as they roll those out, do they have better security features?
LTE, no. This says example 3G. I'm not sure if 4G is, I think 4G is probably the same.
Well, 4G is kind of an umbrella name too.
Yeah. So I doubt that things are going to get better anytime soon.
Jeez. You guys bum me out every week.
See, in some weird way, I think you and I, Lyle, get really excited by security news because we're like, whoa, that's a crazy exploit. You know?
That means your grandma can get your stuff stolen. Yeah, and we're like, wow. And Bonnie's like, no, that's not good at all.
That's not good, you guys. I'm kind of
concerned. We're not excited by the pain. We're excited by the imagination of the...
Yeah.
I don't know. Why is it exciting to us?
It's that in order to do this, you have a complicated system in order to exploit devices on the system, you need to find a way to get past the system.
Yeah.
That's a puzzle. That's a puzzle.
It's a challenge. Rubik's Cube.
And when someone solves a difficult challenge, we're interested.
Yeah. All right.
So that's what
okay. So let's say, Bonnie, that you don't actually use your cell phone and all your communications is some other means.
Yeah.
And then somebody wants to look at your data.
Yeah.
Well, the way they can do that, the government can actually ask for data from companies.
Right.
And we've seen this a lot. And so there's a few reports I want to kind of cover in this realm.
Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about that.
Apple just reported that in 2013, just from January to June 30th, they got 43 different countries demanding information about roughly 40,000 Apple accounts and devices. That's the kind of requests we're talking about, governmental requests.
Governmental requests. So this is people saying, hey, we're suspicious about a person. They're on your network. We'd like to see their information.
The thing that's interesting is that 43 different countries are doing this. Every time Apple or Google or Yahoo or all these companies access in a certain area, the region they're in, that's the legal space.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about 43 countries, we know in the United States, it's pretty pitiful in the sense that demands can happen without much court looking and all
right,
that. But in other countries, who knows what the rules are?
Who
they're
knows
all over
what
the place.
The rules are.
But Apple gets about 40,000 in just a half a year period.
Now, how did we come up with that statistical
Apple released
information?
It.
Is that part of the NSA freak out?
Yeah,
companies
I would say that
wanting
is.
To be more, exactly, transparent,
more transparent
about their, so their cooperation.
And what Apple's saying, another story I'll have a second, is very similar. The quote from Apple, we believe that our customers have a right to understand how their personal information is handled, and we consider it our responsibility to provide them with the best privacy protections available. That's one of the statements Apple said.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they also say, you know, our business model does not depend on collecting personal data, they say.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so with that in mind, and then also Apple's talking about the personal data conversations are encrypted end to end, and they talk about iMessage and FaceTime being completely safe, and that the location information that you store with them because of searches and maps and stuff, they don't store that by a per user in situation, and also Siri requests get anonymized when they get stored, so they save the data about Siri requests, but you can't, and from their system they can't track back who asked the Siri request.
So you can find out what kinds of things people are asking about, but not who or where they were asking.
Except that every time we see that kind of collection of search data, very quickly you find out the search data actually identifies the person pretty easily, because you might do a Siri request that has your name in the search, right?
Right, yeah.
And that,
some of them can be obvious.
Right. So, but in general, Apple's saying we want to be more transparent about what the requests are. So Google also did this, kind of the same kind of thing. And they've released a pretty interesting story talking about the amount of requests. So in like December of 2009, July through December of 2009, they had about 12,000 requests from governments.
Okay.
About 4,000 of that was U.S.
Uh-huh.
This last period, January to June of 2013, they've had 25,000 requests from all governmental and 10,000 or 11,000 or so from the U.S. So we're talking about
a
threefold kind of increase in the U.S. requests.
So they're just getting bigger. They're just asking for more information.
More data, right. So Google is kind of saying, look, and this is the quote from Google that I think is kind of interesting. We believe it's your right to know what kinds of requests and how many each government is making of us and other companies. Google legal director Richard Salguero wrote in a blog post.
Yeah.
However, in the U.S. Department of Justice contends that U.S. law does not allow us to share information about some national security requests that might receive. Specifically, the U.S. government requires that we cannot share information about the requests we receive, if any, under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, but you deserve to know. So this is the company saying, this is all the data we can share.
Yeah.
And specifically, Google's, when they released this, they released an infograph with all these charts and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And one of the infographs is just blacked out with a Sharpie.
That's a visa request.
I'll put it up on GeekSpeak's site.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, but I love the idea that Google's basically just embarrassing the government's secrecy aspect.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, Apple says this and Google says this. Most requests are about like really legitimate legal things, like cell phone stolen. iPhone stolen in the U.S., most of the requests for the U.S. stuff are, hey, can you tell us where this iPhone is? We want to track down the criminal that stole it from this person.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like a very legitimate reason for legal to talk to a company. The thing is, the government will say, well, this is what we're doing.
Uh-huh.
But what needs to be clear is that when you hide information of this sort, it is very hard for, you know, and you mute the speaker of the company, it's muted on it.
Mm-hmm.
It gets really difficult to know when it's inappropriate. And so I strongly believe in this transparency. I like that the companies are kind of embarrassing the government's hidden aspect of it.
Yeah.
I think it's a good thing. And I think this is a Snowden, this is because of Snowden stuff. Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. It's kind of a good thing.
I have a quick and very directly related story. Some people at Stanford Law School basically are starting this project that basically they're saying, hey, download this app, give us your phone records, and then we're going to figure out who you are on Facebook. And the idea is to say, you know, when the National Security Agency says that having all the metadata about your phone calls and all that stuff, like all of the news that's been going around about that, the NSA is saying, no, 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 it's just metadata. It's not real data. But if you take phone calls, you can actually get a ridiculous amount of information about the people. Once you get a little bit of information, you can use that information to get more and more and more.
A little location, a little sequence, and you can form a story of what the conversation is.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that is what this app for this study for Stanford is. And it's really cool.
Oh, cool. It just kind of highlights what the metadata actually can glean.
So, yeah.
That's cool.
You know, on a potentially related note, we have a call from John in Santa Cruz who's curious about what we think of the cloud. Is it safe?
No, well, John, hi. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering if Skynet, I mean, the cloud, is it reasonably trustworthy? I mean, I'd love to get an iPad, but I don't like this idea that I can't use what are they called? The little BUSs, the little plugins for
USBs.
USB sticks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when we talk about the cloud, what we're doing is we're simplifying a giant stack of technology into a fluffy metaphor.
A metaphor, yeah.
And it's just, you know, it used to be that on this show we just talk about the internet and internet service providers and storage on the internet, and that's what we talk about. Now we just always say the cloud. It's really the same thing.
But basically, John, he's talking about there's no USB, so there's no way to get information from one device to another without trusting the cloud.
Yeah, and when we talk about an Apple device, oddly enough, their cloud offering is called iCloud. So this is the service that they're talking about. In this situation, you have to trust that Apple is caring for you because it's completely their systems. They're really good engineers, I would argue. They make a lot of money, too much money to know what to do with, which is kind of interesting. And they know that you feeling good about your experience is important to them. So if they had a security breach, it would really damage their sales.
So yeah, that's really what it's about. When we talk about trust in companies, I mean, I wouldn't just trust a company because, oh, it's they're good people, right? Or the company is a good company. Instead, think about what are their incentives. If they lose your data, you're never coming back to them and you're going to tell all your friends, right? If they have a security breach and someone steals your data, same thing. So it's in everyone's,
In their best interest to make your data safe.
It is. And when the government can request that they give them data and also not tell anyone that they made the request, then how safe is data not only from being lost but from being seen by eyes you don't want it to be seen by?
Yeah. Now, just to let you know, if you do have a computer and you have an iPad, you can turn off all the cloud iCloud services and not have it connect at all. That's what I do. That's what I've done with my iPhone, for example. You don't sync with them. And then you can actually sync to your computer through Wi-Fi or through a USB cable to your computer directly and put files on it and do all that.
You can do that on Android as well.
Yeah. So you don't have to use these cloud services at this point. They are really convenient and cool because they sync between devices, and you'll probably get sucked into that feeling.
But how do you sync between devices if there's no USB?
It's not as easy.
iPad might not be the way to go then for John.
What I did is I switched my iOS to sync through Google instead of Apple, and it's exactly the same thing. Like, there's nothing different except that one was a little harder to do.
For your experience, that is.
But I did it for training. I mean, for learning experiences, exactly. But I think the solution, the thought process you need to take is that, there are going to be vulnerabilities in every computer system. They're too complicated for us not to make them perfect. They're just going to be chinks in the armor. That's just how technology is. Yeah. So the question really has to do with, and the thing that's been most interesting in the last 10 years is that the systems that try to break those chinks are automated, and it's not a person behind it. It's just happening.
It's hammering and hammering.
And the companies are trying to protect themselves the entire time. I think that the amount of, it's a little ridiculous that these companies like Google and Apple are saying, hey, we need more transparency on the government request, because the truth is we don't have transparency on how they do what they do. They make it all proprietary. How that iPhone device connects to the network and then connects to the iCloud and does the syncing, we have bullet points on how it works, but we can't look at the code itself. We don't know if they're encrypting it safely. And that is closed source software. And so it is what is it? You know, do as I say, not as I do. What's
right,
that?
Yeah.
What is it when someone treats you that way? I can't really think of the word.
Patronizing.
What's that?
Pedantic.
Yeah, yeah. Pedantic, definitely. But that's a favorite word here at Geek Speak.
It's paternalistic.
Well, yeah. It seems really ridiculous that the companies, Google and Apple, and those companies are saying, "Oh, be more transparent, government. That's horrible of you." And yet themselves, they're totally
Don't
opaque.
Don't look at me.
Yeah, I just find that kind of disgusting. So. I recommend to people that if they're going to go for an iPad to just turn on cloud, because when their system fails and they lose data, they call me, and I don't want that call.
So for selfish reasons, you want people to go ahead and use the cloud so they have a backup.
Yeah.
My personal feeling is that if you're using cloud services with a company like Google or Apple, your data is probably more secure with them than it is with you.
When it's in there, does it become like everything else on the internet—a permanent thing that is there forever and ever and ever?
Oh, you're talking about like cached things.
Kind of. Yeah, you know, the European Union actually has a really interesting rule set about having a user has the right to get their data erased. So,
any site.
Yeah, basically they have laws in place, governmental rules, that say if over time data should be erased from your systems. So
why is it that they ever made that rule that it has to be permanent?
Well, No one's made a rule that you have to make permanent. I'm saying that specifically, like there's no reason for Google or Apple to have a process in place where they delete data over time. So they save it and they back it up and they keep it. And basically, you ever give it to them, yeah, there'll be some copy of it depending on their regulations and rules. There will be copies on their systems and they might not ever purge them because it's not worth it.
Yeah.
But in the EU, there are laws saying over time you have to get rid of this data, which is just we don't have those rules in place. We need them.
See, I see a point counterpoint to that one. Certainly, because you guys freak me out every week. I'm interested in security of not having it be around forever. But
why is it automatic that it's stored forever?
Because it's harder to make a process that deletes it.
Exactly.
It takes more effort.
Yeah.
But there could be an advantage there in terms of history and correspondence and how things came to be.
Yeah,
because
I think there's some
value
there.
There's no stack of letters people are keeping now. It's all emails out there somewhere. So for historians and biographers and that sort of thing, it could be...
I mean, I personally, I don't delete email that goes into my Gmail account. I haven't run out of space. I just archive it. It's all there since I opened my Gmail account.
Yeah.
And anytime you want,
just
you know, Google's got a really interesting thing that any data that they save for you, you can go and download. There's a whole page about getting your data, and you can just export all of it to your computer anytime you want. They have a whole project that's about opening your data up. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of a neat thing. If you ever want to leave those services, you can go and just dump it to your computer. Now, you're going to have to figure out how to parse that information. It's going to be a whole bunch of text files or whatever. But
yeah,
Ben, you were going to say?
Information management.
No.
So what do you think, John, given what you've heard, what are you going to do about an iPad?
I'm not so sure I'm going to get one still.
Yeah.
Well, you definitely...
My main reason is that I want to have something that... I mean, how is there memory? I mean, if I wanted to have like 20 reference books, could I put them all in the memory of an iPad?
You probably could, yeah.
Yeah, iPads have a pretty good storage. I mean, a book, depending on how many images are in the book, doesn't take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
See, that's why I want to be able to use the sticks, is because I want
sticks.
To be able to plug in a whole book on birds and
now there are
one on mammals. What's that?
Yeah, well, you can extend the memory of an iPad by using a USB to SD card reader or some sort of that nature. It's not how Google's suggesting you do it, and how Apple's suggesting you do it, and therefore it's a little hard to do. But, you know, photo geeks can do this all the time. Like if you have an SD card in your camera and you want to dump your images to there, you can do that kind of thing. So,
but how do you do that if there's no USB port?
You use the existing port on the machine with a little adapter.
Oh.
Yeah. It's
okay.
Not, yeah.
There's some sort of way.
Yep.
Cool.
Right.
Well, good luck, John, figuring it all out. And, you know, congratulations on proceeding with caution. I think it's
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate
a good way to go.
Your help today.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, John. So John called us. Rick took his phone, and he can take yours, too. You can call us at 800-655-5877 if you have questions like John did. For the geeks.
Or any questions.
Or any questions at all. We can attempt why the sky is blue.
Hey, speaking of phones, can I cover another phone story?
In a
minute. Yeah.
Ooh.
And you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP 88.9, also KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primshin. With me in the air room is Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. And we're freaking each other out about just phone security and
I think we're
cloud.
Freaking you out. I knew this was bad.
Am I projecting? Okay.
Yeah, I'm doing just fine.
So, Ben, what's all this about an FCC broadband
speed
up?
Oh, yeah, okay, so check this out. Lyle, you hate carriers. So, this story is just for you. When you're shopping for a mobile phone and you're going to AT&T's website, you're going to Verizon's, and you're going to Sprint's.
No.
Because they're the big ones, so of course those are the ones you're going to choose. Well, you're trying to figure out, will my phone work in my home in the middle of nowhere?
Right.
Yes.
Does it?
Well, you know what I always recommend on GeekSpeak? I say find a friend that has whatever carrier you're thinking about going to, invite them over for dinner, and then call them from the back room. You know, have them test it for you. You basically use friends that have different carriers.
And then call them without them knowing.
That's Why are you calling me?
That's a sample size of one, though.
I don't know. That's pretty pitiful.
But,
it's a way.
Yeah, or text them and see how long it takes them to get the text message.
Ben, do you have another way of finding out?
Well, I do, in fact. So the way we've done it is we've gone to the different websites, and I've done this recently. You know, you open up AT&T's little chart for your home, and you open up T-Mobile's, and you know, you put them all next to each other, and you're like, okay, that one looks like it's a little bit more green in that little area, but it's a little less green.
Yes.
Okay. Those charts, I'm convinced those charts are just BS, right?
Oh, they're definitely BS. I mean, oh, absolutely.
They're kind of right, but the light green, some coverage is no coverage. Yeah. Maybe, you know, close to an area with coverage.
Some people get coverage.
So
that's actually not even what the rule means. It's even worse than that, but go on.
Really?
Yeah, those maps are not about signal strength at all. They're about regulations and possibilities. And they are made up by the carriers
coverage?
Completely. Yes, they're absolutely ridiculous maps. So the maps in this area, for example, say Verizon goes, "Oh, everybody has broadband in this area. You don't need to put in cabling systems here because everybody has Wi-Fi because they have some antennas in that area." Not any other reason.
Not because they know it works.
They don't know if it works at all. Mm. Yeah, and they want to make that ruling so they look better.
So why do we trust the companies that we're asking? I mean, it's like me saying, "Hey, can you do this? And how well can you do that?" And if you ask three or four different people, they're going to give you competing numbers, and they're all going to be fictitious. And then, of course, it's going to end up being over budget. I mean, that's really what happens, right?
Yeah.
So there is now, there will soon be a better solution. So this is, I think, where governmental regulation is a good thing, right? We like to complain about the FCC and all the regulations and all that stuff, but the US FCC just released the smartphone app. And if you go and you download it, what it'll do is it'll track, it'll track where you are, and it'll track all this stuff.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, put your tinfoil hats on, right? But it'll track where you are and your signal strength, and it'll submit all that information to the FCC.
Yeah, baby.
Thousands of people are going to install this app, maybe tens of thousands.
So we're going to map for ourselves what the real coverage is.
The FCC is going to map all of these different carriers and what their actual coverage is, which means you're not going to have to do this anymore after
a while. I love that you're carrying this story because a good friend of mine and supporter of the show, Jim Warner, who works at UCS, he knows all about networking, is awesome. He's kind of telling me this kind of stuff in the background, like what these apps are. I've tested a few of these apps that weren't FCC released, and they're awesome, right? Because they do exactly what you expect. And then these have been like these groundswells. But the point of all this is that you don't really want it to be kind of collected from outside sources and summed together, because whoever does that summing decides on what value each of them are. Mm-hmm. So having it a governmental thing really makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That way, at least, that the goal is to make that better. And so, once this app is released, we will promote it heavily. They'll be making an iOS version and an Android version. I don't know about the Windows Phone version.
Well, they've made the Android version, and it is in public beta, so you can actually download it.
Okay,
now,
cool.
The iOS one is planned. I'm not sure when it will be released. But
yeah, let's do that. Let's see how many people we can get.
Absolutely.
To
fantastic. But you fantastic. Know, since we're talking about cell phones, and I bring up Jim, there's a Linux user group in the area that I kind of pay attention to. Mm-hmm. And these are people that are really interested in their tech. These are the geeks at the geek level, right? These are amazing.
Geeks.
Yeah. Every
geeks.
One of them has this. Anyway, it's a wonderful online conversation I'm having with these people about carrier usage and where cell sites are and stuff. So recently there was a proposed cell site addition to Boulder Creek, a little tiny town up in the mountains, kind of close to where I live. And the idea was that it would be downtown, and it would be one of those fake cell phone trees.
Mm-hmm.
And the carrier, Verizon, promoted this idea of a 40-foot pine tree. Mm-hmm. The problem is there's not 40-foot pine trees in Boulder Creek. They're redwood trees, and they look different.
Yeah.
But also those things always look fake anyway.
Yeah.
So the regulation, basically the request was happening, but Verizon didn't update it in response to the government request, like the local community request.
Mm-hmm.
So it got canceled. It got canned. And it's one of those things where you kind of see the trouble that a carrier has in putting technology in place, right? Their argument is, well, we want to put this in here because we want to increase the coverage in this area and make it better, which would be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe actually I'd get Verizon at my house, which would be awesome. but when it comes down to it, it's a lot of processes because it's a lot of little communities that kind of help decide what gets accepted or not. So this
well,
one
and
failed.
The public in each of those communities has differing opinions yeah. about how they want the cell phone, whether they want them there and
right.
what they want them to
and
look
you know,
like.
And even so when you're like, I want this so bad so I can use my phone, I can you know pay less money or whatever.
Yeah.
The truth is the cell site they're about to put in isn't very secure and we're promoting that, right, all the
yeah.
time. So it's kind of
yeah.
like, well, you're kind of not really good at what you do anyway, but please do it. It's like,
yeah.
ah, I'm not so convinced.
There's no ideal way forward, is what
no. I hear. But I do like the idea of this of FCC kind of putting apps in place to do this kind of checking mm-hmm. because theoretically it could also put in a security model checking. Like you could see more actual codified regulations, which I think is probably important mm-hmm. in this day and age.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic.
It's a good thing to do while you're stationary, but maybe a little dicier while you're driving.
Yes, I actually do have a few more statistics on web surfing and texting and all that stuff while driving. Mainly, I want you guys, the listeners, all of you, to go to this website that I'm going to post on geekspeak.org. It's got a whole bunch of charts and graphs and everything. It's really nice. But the main thing I just want to cover are these new statistics that I found, which are that 24% in 2013, this year, 24% of people read email or
what
have read email while driving.
Stop doing that.
Stop.
That's so dangerous.
And 24%, so about a quarter, have accessed the internet while they're on their phone.
Interesting. Mm. Here's another thing to think about. If you think about texting and driving and you think about doing that kind of stuff while you're driving, keep in mind that other people can see that you're doing that. The cell carrier knows you're traveling and knows what you're doing. So mm-hmm. not that there's any current regulations about it.
But eventually
but
it might be
theoretically,
like
you'll have a track. Like it could
lights.
Be, it would be an interesting art project
yeah.
for a hacker to get the data yeah. of multiple cell sites, look at what phones and therefore the phone numbers are traveling and accessing data mm-hmm. and relatively quickly find out who's doing this. So you're not alone when you're doing that. But more importantly, people are killed every year because of texting and doing that kind of stuff while you're driving. Yeah. It's really simple. You need to do that. You wait until you can pull over, and then you do it. And it does not slow down your travel very much if you pull over and spend 2 minutes on the road. You'll be 2 minutes later. Like, mm-hmm.
yeah.
that's it. It's not
yeah.
a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So
and
do
you can
not
text them and let
text,
them know.
Yeah. And it's not just what you're saying, Ben, is it's not just texting. It's email and phone. We call
yeah,
it texting.
Yeah, just straight up web surfing.
Yeah.
Let's
yeah.
just check the news stories.
So 24% reading email, 24% who have accessed the internet, and then 16 and 17% who have responded to email while driving and reading social media.
Okay.
Social media can really, really wait. I mean, I guess I
yeah.
can understand. I can understand maybe like, okay.
Hold on,
maybe
I just
I
have to like this one statement.
Get this email off or something. I mean, that's not okay, but at least yeah. I can understand the thought process that goes to it. But I mean, reading social media networks, if you're feeling like you have to read social media networks while you're driving, there's something wrong.
Yeah.
In my opinion, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say there's something wrong with your interaction with social media that it's so important that you need to put everyone else on the road in danger because of it.
I don't know if it's so much about the importance of social media or the discomfort with stop and go traffic.
Yeah. Mm.
Just not being able to distract your mind for 1 second.
Yeah.
And better driving happens with focus, of course. Being aware of the people around you who might be texting and tweeting while they're
yeah.
while they're driving. It's just, guys, just take a deep breath and look around
let's,
you.
Let's just also talk about the numbers. When you look at the numbers of this kind of stuff, it's as bad as drinking and driving.
Yeah.
So you know that drinking and driving is bad. People do it anyway because, of course, their ability to decide what's good and bad when you drink is damaged, and therefore they drive, right? They don't know it. But you know it when you're driving that you should know it, that if you look at your phone while you're driving, it's just like drinking vodka while you're driving. Do not do it.
Yeah.
People die all the time. Stop.
And
stop.
If you didn't know, now you do.
Yes, that's
this
right. Now you have no excuse.
Service announcement from Geekspeak.
Let's take a call, shall
it's
we?
It's the cell phone version of the show. Yeah, Rich in SoCal's got a question about smartphones and
hey,
recording
Rich.
Conversations.
I do, but also, but before that, if you are in your car and you're using Google Navigate to GPS your way to somewhere, yeah. won't that show up in your measure of accessing the internet and moving from cell tower to cell tower?
Yes.
Yeah, and there's an argument to be made there, too. I mean, I've done that a couple of times, used the phone to find my way someplace, and it is a more distracting way to drive. It's as bad as reading a text.
Mm. Well, when I drove to San Francisco last, I just had the phone sitting on the seat, and like every 20 miles, it would say,
get ready to get off at 380 or something.
Oh, that's true.
That's distracting.
So theoretically, in the situation, let's say somebody said, you know, you get in an accident and you kill some people, and they look, and you get your phone usage subpoenaed, right? So then there's data traffic happening. Yeah. Then you make a request to Google and say, what was going on at that point? Google can say you were using a visualless interface to access map data. That's all that was happening. And bango, it's not because of that. It was because you were drinking instead.
Okay. I was just wondering whether the statistics weed those out.
The statistics wouldn't read that stuff out necessarily unless Google participated in the survey, because that data would be encrypted. At least it would be data encrypted. You could make an argument that it would be different. The SMS, though, would be very transparent. The web searching would most likely be transparent as well.
Yeah, just for the record, the source for all this is State Farm, Governor's Highway Safety Association, and the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety Studies.
All right. Okay. Now, Rich, we've just got a minute left, so did you want to ask your question?
Yeah, if I can, real quick. I need to do some phone interviews for an article, and I've downloaded 6 apps on my Motorola Razr running Android 4.1 something or other. Half of them fail, saying they're not supported on my system, and the other half installed but don't record anything but sort of staticky noise. My question is there something in the phone, or is it an Android that's blocking it?
What's happening is the carrier that you have has restrictions on the operating system to be able to do some things and some not things. They're basically saying none of your applications on an operating system can access the audio of the phone call. If you hack your phone and do a CentOgen mod version on your phone, you will still be able to use your network, and you'll have that feature. If you get a Google Direct download like an Android 4.4, you can as well. Depending on your carrier, that's legal or not.
Okay.
A totally separate way of doing it is Google Voice, but you're going to have to Google how to do that. You can record phone calls with Google Voice.
And I think
Google
you can do it with Skype as well, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But Google, so then you can get a different phone number, basically, is what Ben's talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Rich. Hey, Miles wrote us saying, hey, guys, good show. He points out that there's another mobile OS. It's Firefox.
Oh, yeah. Oh, not in the U.S. yet.
Not in the U.S., but in the U.S., there are laws mandating data retention over time, he says, and that a modern tablet, this is a reassurance for John, can easily hold thousands of books. So this has been Geek Speak for November 16th, 2013. Geek Speak is a registered service trademark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. This is 88.9 KUSP Public Radio and KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. We are a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so go ahead and do whatever you like with our stuff. Just let people know that you got it from us. And thank you for listening.
Thanks, Bonnie.